Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a lot going on this week, and we start off with a great pop rock band from Toronto, Poor Young Things. We chat about their new album, what bands influenced them, and their upcoming cross-country tour. I let you know about a health crisis I've been facing the last 3 months called cervicogenic dizziness that was brought on by a car accident I had 3 years ago. Author and behavior expert Beverly Flaxington stops by to talk about how to get along with your coworkers, and then we wrap things up with Gina Lee and The Love Zone and a remix from Luciana, You Be the Bass.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is lead singer of Toronto's Poor Young Things, Matt Fratpietro. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Kelly.
So, Matt, talk to us about your band. How did you guys actually come together, and how would you characterize your sound for Poor Young Things?
Well, we all went to high school together. We're from Thunder Bay, Ontario, so we're kind of just outside, not really just outside Winnipeg, but really the only town between Winnipeg and Toronto, just a big town, you know. So we all went to high school together. We all played in different bands, and we shared a similar styles of music, and we just kind of came together in that way.
Awesome. And what would you how would you characterize your sound?
Oh, our sound. I think we draw from a lot of different things. I think there's indie, but there's some classic rock. There's, you know, a little bit of everything. Hip-hop beats. No,
nice.
Maybe not hip-hop beats. We try to, you know, we have a pretty eclectic taste in music through the five of us. So it kind of, like, it definitely finds its way into our tunes.
And I wanted to ask you about the band's name. How did you guys come upon Poor Young Things? How was that decided?
There's a guy named Peter Elkis, who's a Toronto musician, fairly renowned, mm-hmm. and he put out a song with Joel Plaskett, and it's called Poor Young Things, and the first line is, you and me, let's make a band, we'll call it Poor Young Things, and we were like, well, let's just do what he says, and we did.
That's awesome. That's a great story. That's fantastic. And, I, you know, you mentioned Thunder Bay and it being sort of the lonely town between the two major cities, I guess, if you will. You think coming from Thunder Bay and then moving to the T-Dot, if you will, the Big Smoke, has being in Toronto changed how you guys are as a band, or are you still all the same boys from Thunder Bay?
I think as people we're the same, but I think that it definitely has influenced the music. I mean, Toronto is a mecca of Canadian music and talent and all sorts of genres and styles. So you can go out and you can see on any given night, you can see any number of bands and musical, you know, genres. So it definitely opened our eyes a bit.
Now, moving from Thunder Bay to Toronto, was it culture shock for you? And do you miss Thunder Bay quite a bit, or have you adapted nicely to being in Toronto?
There was a bit of a culture shock at the beginning, for sure. I mean, Thunder Bay, you can pretty much just drive anywhere, regardless of where it is. But here, that's not really an option sometimes. So, you know, taking the subway, we got big buildings, lots of different types of folks. I think that it's not that far away. It's only 16 hours.
Only 16?
For us who drive everywhere, I mean, it's not 16 hours. It's like a drop in the hat.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, if I understand things correctly, when you're not touring, most of you still live together in the same house in Toronto. Does that get frustrating to be together all the time, or has it made you like a tighter unit?
I think we know each other very well, and I think that it's made us a tighter unit. I mean, we all, if we get sick of each other, we can go to our separate areas of the house. Everyone's got their own room. Nobody's living on the couch or anything.
Great.
But we have one, you know, there's one area with the TV, and if we want to go there and hang out, we can do that.
Fantastic.
Or if we want to be alone, we can do that.
That's good. So you got lots of options going on.
And it definitely serves the music better, because if someone has a song idea or a guitar line, we can just hop down in the basement and jam it out. We don't have to call anybody and wait 2 hours for them to take the TTC here from, you know, Kipling.
That's awesome. And I wanted to speak to you actually about your writing process. So is it that you guys all jam together, or I understand that you write most of the lyrics. So do you sort of start first? Does the music start first? Is there like a set plan, or is it all very organic?
I don't think there's ever really a set plan. You know, sometimes I'll come up with some chords or a guitar line and bring it to the guys, and then we kind of jam through that, and they add their ideas into it. Or, you know, vocals always come last. You know, lyrics are always last. So we'll jam it out first, and then I usually just kind of hum a line, just try to come up with something. But everybody definitely has input in everything. I just maybe am the guy who brings, you know, the spark to the idea.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is lead singer from Poor Young Things, Matt Fratpietro. Now, can you talk to us about your new album, which comes out on May 21st, The Heart, The Head, The End? Does the CD have like an overall theme, and what do you want your fans and new fans to take away from it?
That's a good question. I think the theme is definitely, it's a more of a relationship-based album. I mean, we all, or most of us have girlfriends, and they don't live in Toronto. They live in Thunder Bay, so it's a long way, and you miss them sometimes. And you know, it's just about our experience in the past year, being on the road, meeting lots of people. We've obviously had lots of funny moments, and you know, stories and things like that. I think the as our first EP was kind of an overview of our first year in Toronto, I think this one is similarly an overview of our, whatever this is, third year, I guess.
And can you speak to us about the album title? Like, where did you come up with that?
These are great questions. I never thought about any of this stuff before.
I'm making you work, Matt. I'm making you work.
I think that just based on the relationship aspect of the album, I think The Heart, The Head, The End was kind of an overall tie up of everything. You know, it's either when you're dealing with things, you're going with your gut or you're thinking with your mind, and that's really all there is. I mean, that was a bad answer. I'm trying to come up with a really good answer for this question, but it definitely is. What can I say here? I blew it, Kelly.
I love it. I love it. It's okay. That's good enough. I want to...
It's an emotional title.
Oh, well, that's good. I love that. That's great. Yeah. That was a good comeback. I love it. Now, I want to talk to you. You spoke again about, you know, the 16 hours to Thunder Bay not really being a big deal. You have obviously, you know, traversed across Canada touring. Do you hope to have the same experience picking up things across, let's say, the U.S. or Europe or, you know, Asia and Australia? Like, I feel like there must be a certain vibe across the country that you pick up upon. And do you look forward to maybe gaining experiences overseas as well?
Absolutely. Everyone's been awesome. Everywhere we go, people are so nice to us, and the people that come out to our show, all the fans across this country. But even when we go down into the States, people are insanely nice. You always hear that people are more, I don't know, mean down there or something, but everyone's been so nice to us. All the bands that we've played with from the States have been very helpful. No one's been, you know, crappy to us. It's just an incredible experience to drive and play, you know? It's something that a lot of people don't get the opportunity to experience.
How important is social media for the success of Poor Young Things?
I think social media is important to the success of any band from here on out. I mean, it's a way to, for someone across the world to hear your song. And it's something that you weren't always able to do, but now there's this platform where you can put a song out there. People can comment on it. People can share it. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, and I'm glad that we're in an era where that's a possibility.
Do you have a favorite, Matt? Like, are you a Twitter guy? Do you like Facebook? Do you enjoy the SoundCloud? Like, what's your favorite?
I like Instagram a lot.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Because it's easy. You don't have to really come up with a witty, witty Twitter little sentence thing. You just pop a picture on there and people take from it what they want.
Awesome. That's great. Now, I wanted to speak to you as well. Who would you say has influenced the band? Like, what other artists? And are there artists or bands that you would love to collaborate with?
I think we've definitely been influenced by a lot of bands. Arkells is a big one. Those guys have a lot of energy. I think we kind of try to model our live show after them a bit. Obviously, we're big Tragically Hip fans, being Canadian boys.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of, even like Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen, like it's a lot of things that bleed into our sound.
Now, I want to ask you specifically as the lead singer, do you have a guilty pleasure that you would, you know, admit to here? Like, do you enjoy... like Nicki Minaj or something? Like, is there something that would be sort of far out from what you do as a band that Matt likes?
I don't know if there'd be anything I'd feel guilty about.
Oh, that's good. Good answer, too. I like that.
I mean, yeah, I listen to a lot of different things, and I think you just got to own it.
Fantastic.
You got to own it. Don't call it a guilty pleasure. I think there was an interview with Dave Grohl where he said that. He said, you just own it, you know.
Good. Now, before I let you bounce, I want to ask you, what can the fans expect to see from Poor Young Things in the next, you know, 12 months to 18 months? Like, obviously, the album coming out, are you going to tour across Canada? Like, what can we expect?
Yes, the album comes out May 21st, and we will be starting our tour in Ottawa, and we're going to be going out to the East Coast, and we're going to be going all the way to the West Coast, full across Canada. We'll be dipping down into the States again, maybe going over to Europe. It's a possibility at this moment. We'll see how that pans out. But, yeah, definitely Canada and the U.S. We're going to be very busy this year. I'm very excited because since we finished the album, we've just been sitting around the house, and I'm starting to get cabin fever.
Time to go. Time to hit the road.
There's only so much, you know, baseball I can watch on TV.
Gotcha. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Matt from Poor Young Things. Again, for more information, check them out, pooryoungthings.com.
Hey, this is Matt from Poor Young Things, and you're listening to The Kelly Alexander Show.
There's a wall on the middle class, and everybody feels so insecure. But I don't want to be like that, and work my hands to dust. These automatic love machines on the radio never meant shit to me. But baby, better know her math, cause art is not enough. Sound of the times. We don't do all the crazy.
Kelly Alexander Show for a while, you know that I like to keep you up to date with what's going on with me, because you and I have that sort of relationship. I like to share things that's going on with me in case you can either learn from it or we can share experiences together. And something that sort of happened to me about 3 months ago is very important, and I wanted to share it with you because it really sort of turned me upside down. At the end of January, I started getting these feelings in my head, and I wasn't sure what was going on. I had like a bit of soreness going on, and then like shooting pain in my head. And of course, you don't want to be that person, but you immediately think you have a brain tumor. And I was fortunate that I was able to get in to see my doctor fairly quickly. And we discovered that what I had actually is called cervicogenic dizziness, which is actually a problem with your neck. And it stems from, or it can stem from, whiplash. And I actually had a car accident about 3 years ago, and I had no idea that you can actually hold whiplash in your head for, or your neck rather, for months, if not years. And that's exactly what seemed to have happened to me. Even though immediately following the car accident in April of 2010, I did get treatment for it, but I guess it wasn't enough, or I don't know. But anyways, it came out at the end of January, as I mentioned. I started having shooting pains. Then I sort of had this feeling in the side of my face that it was like almost like numb from the dentist. And then the symptoms sort of progressed into having this neck pain where it, like anytime I would tilt my head forward, you know, even just an inch, all of a sudden I would get this feeling like I was going to be dizzy. And again, that's when the doctor diagnosed me with this cervicogenic dizziness. And it's a bit of a controversial diagnosis because not everyone actually concurs or believes that this is actually a thing, but it is, and you can go online and find it. And basically the treatment for it is to go see an osteopath or some sort of professional who can do proper massage techniques and sort of work the muscles and all that sort of stuff. And basically what needs to happen is the muscles in your neck have to be released so that you get the proper blood flow to your brain, because that's what was happening with me. When I would lean forward or lean to the side, anything that wasn't sort of directly, you know, vertical, I wasn't getting enough blood to the brain, and that was that reason why I sort of felt like I was going to be dizzy. And it's very uncomfortable. It's very frustrating because you cannot work on the computer. You cannot read. You cannot, you know, bend over to tie your shoelace without sort of feeling, again, like you're going to be dizzy. And it's very crippling. And so I was very grateful to get the diagnosis and to find out that it was something that I could deal with. And so for the beginning part of February, I was off to the races. I was seeing the osteo and things were actually going very well. And the time frame was sort of about a month, that it would take about a month to get this to work out. Anyways, near the end of February, I got a head cold. And it wasn't even a bad head cold, but it actually was enough to cause me problems with regards to my previous diagnosis of the cervicogenic dizziness. Basically, what happened is the head cold, even though, again, it wasn't even a bad one, I felt over it within the first 3 or 4 days. But what happened is my sinuses were still blocked. And basically, because my neck was blocked with this cervicogenic dizziness, and then my sinuses were blocked, it's like my head didn't have any place to go with regards to having the fluids flow properly. So I ended up getting this feeling like I was swaying on a boat, like back and forth. Anytime I was out of a vertical position, again, bending forward to the side, trying to lie down to go to sleep, you get this awful feeling like you're rocking on a boat. And I can tell you it's a very scary feeling to have, especially because, again, you can't do anything. Like, my only relief was sort of standing up straight, walking, or sitting and sort of on the couch at a very like 90 degrees angle where I would be very, you know, fairly vertical and watching television. Like, I can't even tell you, you can't even read a book. You cannot be out of a vertical position or everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And as you can imagine, if you've, again, been listening to the show for a while, I'm sure you've sort of picked up on the fact that I'm a type A personality. I like doing lots of things, getting things done and accomplished. And basically, with this illness or injury, whatever you want to call it, I was, you know, knocked on my butt. And it was very difficult to get this show ready, you know, because this requires a fair amount of being on the computer and doing research and all that sort of stuff. It was, you know, very difficult to get the show done. It was very difficult to even do my day job, which is being a radio announcer. And I was fortunate that I was able to sort of just be able to handle things well enough that I could do bits and pieces and get things done that way. But again, The whole experience was very limiting, very frustrating, especially because, you know, you think you're taking a step forward and then you take a step back. And as we speak right now, I'm still not over it because guess what? Guess who caught another head cold? I was actually doing fairly well a couple of days ago, and I was really starting to feel like myself. I was able to actually get back to the gym, doing very light sort of exercises. And then I caught this stupid head cold a couple of days ago. And as you can imagine, it scared the bejesus out of me because, you know, that's what made everything bad the last time. Fortunately, I was able to go see my osteopath, and he sort of said, he's like, you're stronger than you were, you know, a month ago. So he's like, it's not good that you have this cold, but he's like, I think we can get you through this. So that was a couple of days ago. Fortunately, I've been doing pretty good, although I still have, you know, some of the symptoms, and I'm not sort of out of the dark tunnel yet, if you will, although I do see the light at the end of the tunnel. But this has been like a 3-month affair of basically my life being on hold and very frustrating for me. And probably, again, this injury or this illness, if you want to call it that, is the first real health crisis that I've suffered as an adult. Like when I was a kid, I think I've mentioned before, I had a ruptured appendix when I was 11 years old. And that was a devastating experience because it didn't get diagnosed right away. And it actually did rupture in my stomach. So I had all these, you know, complications. And I probably wasn't myself for a year. It probably took about a year for me when I was 11 to get back to being, you know, how I felt normal. But this thing has been like the first time as an adult where I've really been knocked on my butt and really had my life sort of interrupted. So I finally wanted to share it with you because as you can imagine, when I was going sort of through the main part of it, it was very disconcerting. It was very upsetting and a bit scary too, because I did go to see a couple of doctors. They wanted to make sure that my inner ear was still functioning properly. And I have to say that I had a really great ear, nose, and throat doctor. Although the scary thing is when he sort of gave me the results, he's like, you know, technically, Kelly, he's like, your inner ear is fine. He's like, you know, there's no reason for you to be having these symptoms of you feeling like you're swaying on a boat. And I said, okay, I said, that's really great news that there's nothing wrong with my inner ear technically or functionally. But I said, I still have these symptoms. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And he said, I said, are they going to go away? And he said, well, they should, but he's like, they might not. And I'm like, what do you mean they might not? And he's like, well, you could have this for life. And I can tell you that that scared me so much. And it really upset me because the way he sort of said it was very sort of non-compassionate, if you will. And I don't really blame him because, you know, he has, you know, probably a million patients that he has to see. And I find a lot of times doctors are very sort of clinical and they don't have a lot of compassion. On some levels they do, and then in others they might not. And I feel that that's how he sort of treated me. And it was a very scary sort of statement to hear back, but I sort of pushed through it and I said, no, I'm not gonna feel this way forever. So I've been very adamant that I'm gonna, you know, get back to normal. And my osteopath is such a rock star. He's amazing. And he's like, don't worry, you are gonna be normal again. We're gonna get you through this. And like I said, the last couple of weeks, things have been going much, much better. But I guess the main reason why I wanted to tell you this is, again, to sort of keep you up to date with what's going on. Again, sharing my experiences so if you can learn from this. Because again, this diagnosis of cervicogenic dizziness is controversial and some people may not believe in it. So if you, again, have any symptoms like this, you might wanna check this out. Again, leaning forward and feeling like you're going to be dizzy. The other reason I wanted to share it with you as well is because you really have to become your own advocate. As much as I really enjoy the doctors, and I'm so appreciative that I can go and see a doctor and have them check me out, and my GP is amazing. He's very caring and very wonderful. You really have to take things upon yourself and not think that other people are going to have the answers for you. You really need to be your own advocate. And I've heard, you know, Oprah Winfrey say that before and lots of other people, but it's really something you need to keep in your head that if you are experiencing something and you don't know what it is, it really behooves you to take, you know, the initiative and be proactive and take care of yourselves because you know, and seek professional help and get what you can from the professionals, but they can only do so much, again, because they have all these patients and they can't always keep, you know, each and every one of us at the top of the list and priority. So really be proactive, really take care of yourself. And also, I guess my final point would be to believe in yourself and believe that you are going to get through it. This has made me stronger. I thought I was a pretty strong individual before, but this whole experience, you know, again, feeling like you're swaying on a boat 24/7, really grates on your patience and grates on your ability to think you're ever going to be normal. And I want to give a shout out to my mom, Mommy Alexander, as well as the rest of my family and friends, because there were times where I just needed to have a good cry and get a hug, because again, feeling like you're swaying on a boat 24/7 is really uncomfortable. It's really awful. You take your balance for granted. You never realize how important your balance is until you don't have it. So, you know, that's another thing. Just be grateful for every moment that you have, that you feel healthy. And again, that's not something new. I'm sure you've heard that from lots of people, you know, in your life, or maybe you've experienced yourself. But really take a moment every single day and be grateful for your health and your happiness and your mental, you know, well-being, because when you don't have it, nothing else matters. And I can tell you, you know, I'm so proactive about my career, and I love doing the show, and I love talking to you guys and getting your emails and sort of conversing with you on Facebook and all that sort of stuff and our other social media. But I really learned a big lesson. Like, when you do not have your health, you have nothing. So it's really important to take care of yourself. And that's why on this show, we always try to bring you ideas and bring you things that can help you, you know, be a healthy and happy individual. And that's what we like to do here on the Kelly Alexander Show. So thank you so much for listening. And I really hope you can take something away from this experience. I have, that's for sure. And again, if you have any comments or questions, I always appreciate hearing from you. And you can reach out to me, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
So many times our relationships begin to suffer when we don't communicate properly. We come home from work frustrated and annoyed with that pesky person at the office. Sometimes it's easier to ignore that coworker you butt heads with, or take the passive-aggressive route with a partner rather than recognize and deal with the problem. Here to help us learn ways to identify communication problems and how to deal with them is two-time best-selling author, behavior expert, and career coach, Beverly Flaxington. Beverly, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Beverly, what are the first signs that a work relationship needs healing?
Well, it's a good question, Kelly, because my advice to people is first you want to look at impact. So does it really need healing? Is it somebody that just annoys me? Is it somebody that I just get frustrated with? Or do I have an impact problem? In other words, is this person actually preventing me from doing my job effectively? So you want to make sure that you are identifying the seriousness of it before you even think about taking action, because we waste so much energy on things that really, in the final analysis, don't matter.
Okay. And what are some of the most underlying, you know, common issues that cause a breakdown in communication?
Well, a very big one is that we have differences in behavioral style. So I may be a very, you know, assertive, go out and get the results kind of person. I like to take things on. And I may be working with somebody who prefers to be a little bit more thoughtful. There's somebody that would rather just take their time to think about things and make a plan. Well, they're getting put off by my aggressive style, and I'm getting put off by their quote-unquote slow-moving approach. Same types of things. Some people are talkers. Other people are thinkers. So a lot of times what's happening is it's a difference in style, the body language we have, the tone of voice we use. So I'm not even reacting so much to what my colleague is doing or saying as much as the way that they're saying it.
When it's something like that, where it's two different styles, how do you work through that?
Well, I tell people the first thing is we have to recognize our own triggers. So it's interesting if you think about it, Kelly, with difficult people. You and I could be in an office together, and I'm so frustrated by a coworker, can't stand this person. And you might say, old so-and-so, I've worked with that person forever. I really like that person. Why are they difficult to me but not to you? Because things are triggered in us by other people. So the first thing is to look at what are our triggers? What is it about that person that's bothering me? Then again, I have to go back to impact. You know, do I want to improve this relationship? Does my job really depend on this, and do I need to really work with this person? Let's say the answer is yes. I want to get along with them. I want to then watch, become what I call an interested observer. More clinical, more objective, seeing what is it that they're doing, and then taking steps to actually try and match their behavior. It's a technique that a lot of good salespeople use. I watch someone else's body language, their tone, the words they use, how they approach things, and I'm trying to match what I'm delivering in terms of communication to that person. It enables them to hear me more effectively, and I actually find that I can collaborate with them more, and we're able to work together.
And is it, you know, a long time before someone realizes that their, you know, communication skills are not doing so well at work? Like, I feel like you might be well into the problem before you realize that, you know, stuff's not going well.
such a good insight because, you know, a lot of times I think people say, how did I wind up here? You know, how did this evolve this way? And so what has to happen is at the moment that we do realize it, this is when we want to go into, again, what I often call kind of a clinical mode or a detective mode or an observer mode. And I want to look at what is transpiring here. You know, is this happening every day? Is this happening in certain situations? Is it always happening in front of my boss or with someone else? So I really do want to examine what exactly is it that's going on. You know, we get so drawn in that we react emotionally, and so we lose our ability to have choices about what we're going to do. So I do in some ways want to take the time, no matter at what point I realize it, to diagnose it. Now, the good news is you can, in fact, make some shifts, make some changes in how you approach someone, and no matter how long it's been going on, you may be able to get a change on their part simply because you're shifting the way you're dealing with them, no matter how long it's been going on.
Joining us on the show is two-time best-selling author, behavior expert, and career coach Beverly Flaxington. Make sure to check out her website, www.understandingotherpeople.com. Beverly, you just talked about, you know, coworkers and dealing with that. And again, the impact, do I need to fix this relationship? What happens if it's a boss-employee relationship and it's become difficult? Can you actually turn things around to your favor?
Well, unfortunately, if I'm the employee, and I tell people that we coach all the time this, Kelly, you know, the onus is on me. So a lot of people spend a lot of time wishing their boss was different, hoping their boss will change, thinking it's the boss that needs help. Well, unfortunately, the boss is in the boss role. And as long as they're there, the onus really is on me as a subordinate. I'm not saying it's fair, but it's the way that it works in the real world. So what I have to do then is pay careful attention to what it is that my boss seems to need, what their style is, and am I able to make some adaptations to deal with this person a little bit more directly? Am I able to understand a little bit more about what they're looking for from me? Sometimes in my experience, it's confusion about expectations. So I have to make sure I'm really clarifying. But we have seen situations where the boss, you know, takes on a whole different demeanor towards someone who is making an effort. But the problem is a lot of people just don't want to make the effort. They just simply want the boss to change. Now, if it's a difficult situation and the boss is really unethical, immoral, or any of the above, you have to leave. I mean, there are times where leaving is your best option. But if it's just simply that this person's hard to get along with or they never seem happy with what you do, figure them out. You can change that situation, but the onus is on you to do it. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
Okay. Now, in your book, Understanding Other People, The 5 Secrets to Human Behavior, you know, you do talk about 5 secrets to understanding other people. Can you talk a little bit more about what these 5 secrets are?
Sure. So I call secret number one, it's all about me. And this has to do with the filters. You know, you think about as marketers, for example, we're trying to tell someone about our product, about our service, and we talk about how it's so great. Well, that person listening is filtering through their own life experience. How do I understand this? Where does this fit in with what I understand? And we often don't realize that we think we're being so clear. We think we're so direct. We think our communication, you know, leaves no room for misunderstanding. And yet we're overlooking all the time. Somebody else has their filters. I've got mine. You've got yours. It colors the way we understand things. Number two is our behavioral styles come between us. And we talked about this a little bit, Kelly, in the assertive versus planner. We have different styles, different approaches in how we communicate, and those styles get in the way of the communication. It's not what we say, how we say it. The third one is our values speak more loudly than we do. So if I'm somebody who, let's say, puts a huge emphasis on, I love to help people, I have a strong social value, a do-good value, and I work with somebody who doesn't share that value at all. In fact, they have a utilitarian business value. I might look at that person as an evil person. They don't care about the important things in life, and they look at me as a bleeding heart. You know, I'm not taking this seriously enough. So we judge and we put a subjective moniker on somebody because of a values difference. Fourth one quickly is don't assume I know what you mean. This is where we get into trouble because it's crystal clear to me. Why isn't it clear to you? But again, sometimes the way I'm delivering that communication doesn't allow you to understand. And then the last one I call, I'm okay, you're most definitely not okay. And that has to do with our desire to change everybody else out there. You know, the other person is the problem. And if they would just make the shift, instead of realizing, you know, none of us are really taught these skills at a young age, so we're all doing our best. And if we all were to take a little bit more responsibility in relationships, the reality is they'd be overall much more effective. So we waste so much time wanting the other person to change.
And a question I would have as well, let's say, you know, you've had some sort of, you know, dramatic or traumatic experience happen at work where you've been demoted or shifted around and you yourself as an employee are not happy about it. And I think anyone who is human would, you know, have to go through probably a bit of a mourning process or, you know, just maybe even being in a bad mood for a bit, just trying to sort through their feelings and even trying to be okay at work, but just having to deal with it. If you are going through that and you are going through a rough time, you're still getting your work done, but you know, probably your coworkers are noticing that you're not in a good space. When you do come out of that zone and change things around and maybe you've decided, you know what, I'm just going to be positive anyway, can that really change maybe how people are looking at you and maybe things can really be positive on all fronts at this point with your employees and even your employer?
I love that question because it's such a common thing that you see evolve. So there's two pieces to it. First of all, if I'm the person who's going through something, I certainly don't have to share all my dirty laundry, but not enough of us will say, you know, right now I'm in the midst of something that I don't want to talk about, but I just want you to know that, you know, it is, there will be times where you may observe me not in the best of moods. You know, I don't want to talk about it. I want you to understand. So I've set the expectation with my colleagues and my coworkers that I'm not going to come in here and be really happy. Now, yes, they're going to ask me what's going on. Can I help you? We open the door, but at least we've set the expectation about what's happening. So they're not reading my behavior as, oh, Beth's mad at me, or, oh, you know, she's got a bad attitude, or, oh, you know, what's wrong with her? But let's say I'm not comfortable, so I go through this, and they're reading me, and it's somewhat negative, and then I come in, and all of a sudden, I'm upbeat, I'm happy. After I'm through whatever the difficulty is, again, I recommend saying, you probably noticed that I was not so upbeat, not so negative for a while. I was going through some difficult things. I'm not comfortable talking about it, but I just want you to know I'm on the other side of it now. And again, we can all relate to that. It's when we don't share, we don't give context, the assumptions that we make, that we get into trouble, because people will filter it in whatever way they can understand it. And it helps us a lot to just say what it is. Now, again, I don't advise going and sharing all of your private life issues, but you certainly can say to somebody that was a rough patch.
And why is it that someone, you know, can say one thing to us and then we hear something completely different? Because then your communication just all over the place.
You know, my favorite Joe Kelly for myself, I say when I had my corporate job, I was always termed as a rabble rouser because I wanted to change things. I saw opportunities for improvement. And although I got to very senior level positions, it caused me a lot of angst because I was always in trouble for, you know, bringing up what we could do differently. Now as a consultant, I say the exact same things in the same manner and people pay me for it. So, you know, context is everything, right? I mean, I say it the same way. I say the same things. And that's really what it's about. So it depends, you know, who's receiving it, you know, how confident and comfortable is this person in their own skin? What's the environment that I'm saying it in? And this is why, you know, as we get more savvy with some of this, we will take into account these factors. I could have 10 clients and I will approach them differently depending on who they are. So we need to pay attention to our environment, to the people we're dealing with, and then we are going to make conscious modifications sometimes in the way we deliver information, because context matters more than we typically, you know, understand it to.
Hanging out with us on the show this week is two-time best-selling author, behavior expert, and career coach, Beverly Flaxington. Check out her website, understandingotherpeople.com. Now, Beverly, I know that you are recognized as a confidence coach. How much of a role does confidence play in improving communication and our relationships?
I think it plays a lot, because what often goes on with us is I perceive, you know, let's say you and I are working in the office together, Kelly, and we come in, and let's say you had, it was a tough drive in, maybe, you know, your mother called in the way, your dad's sick, you know, you're worried about him, so there's things going on, and then I walk by you in the hall, and you don't look at me, you just have your head down. Well, what do most of us do right there in that moment? Oh my gosh, why is Kelly mad at me? We take it in and we look at it as, this impacts me. Now, again, not everyone, someone who knows you well might say, oh, gee, that's not Kelly at all. Let me go in and see what's going on. But unfortunately, more times than not, we will take it on as, this person is doing something to me, or I've done something to upset this person. And so that's really where confidence comes in, that I think we need to often turn it around and have, in my mind, confidence allows us to have more compassion and more sensitivity, because my view really is more about what's happening with you rather than trying to protect me or trying to see, you know, now I'm going to tear you down because you slighted me. Well, you know, I've never really liked her anyway. She's not a very nice person. So that inner sense of confidence allows us, I believe, to be more compassionate and not hubris, right? We're talking about confidence, that calm sense of I'm okay. So not talking about over the top ego, but when you have that calm sense of confidence, it allows you to really look outside yourself and to take what's going on with other people into account. And I think have a much heightened sensitivity to what's happening with others, because I'm not so me focused.
Now, I know, you know, you're a different person when you're at home and at work, like not necessarily, but yeah, obviously there's different facets of you that have to come out, you know, with whatever environment you're in. And I'm assuming that because of that, communication breakdowns happen differently, whether it's the work environment or the home environment. So does this mean that dealing with this and the healing process is also different?
Yes. So what's interesting, we use a tool, a behavioral tool called DISC, and that's what secret number two is about. And it is about our preference on four different scales of behavior. The truth is that we actually are at the core the same person, and a lot of times we'll run them for clients of ours in the corporate world, and they'll tell us, oh, I took it home to my spouse, and my spouse said that was me to a T. So we think we're very different, but the reality is we do bring the same preferences to every situation. What we do differently, Kelly, is that in certain work environments, we have to make an adaptation. We have to shift. The boss is asking us to be a certain way, the culture, the job. And so what actually happens to many of us is we're making an adaptation that's not our true selves. I call it putting on someone else's clothes or someone else's shoes. And I'm walking around all day in someone else's shoes. Well, by the end of the day, I'm drained. It's really stressing me. It draws on my energy. So what happens is, you know, then I go home and I don't have a lot left for the people that are there. And so they're then looking to me too. And, you know, my stress level or my depletion is so much that I don't have a lot more to give. So we have to pay attention to that, because we do tend to then bring it home and have a harder time, you know, giving our all to the people that we live with. And unfortunately, this happens a lot in, you know, the day-to-day lives of most people. So you have to put that focus. You've got to find that reserve somewhere and put that energy on those home relationships too, because, I mean, it requires the same kinds of things that we're talking about here.
Now, let's say you have been working on your relationship with a coworker, or even, you know, your partner at home, and you've been in a rut for a while, and let's say things are starting to get better. Is it easy for you to recognize that things are starting to get better? Because sometimes I'm wondering if you're in a rut, you can't see out of it. And then, you know, I guess part two of that question is, if things are starting to go better and you do recognize that things are starting to go better, how do you prevent heading back to the rut?
Yes, and so you have identified another thing that we see a lot. You know, we'll do coaching, we'll be asked by the boss to come in and coach someone, and the person will just be making, you know, significant strides. And, you know, the boss will point out, well, they're still doing this or they're still doing that. And again, you know, this goes back to the filters, right? I have a certain view of this person. I have an expectation of this person. So there is absolutely no question that sometimes it can take us a long time to shift that other person's view of us. But it really is about being consistent, and it's about just continuing to do it over and over and over again. Now, there are some people that want us to stay in the same place, right? I mean, they don't want us to improve or to change. And so they're going to paint us with whatever brush they have, and they're going to keep us painted that way. And there may not be anything that we can do to overcome that. But I do believe that you want to still be consistent with it, because you want to do everything you can to shift this relationship. To your second question, is it easy for us to fall back into old habits? It absolutely is, although what I've observed a lot with the people that I've worked with and teams is that we'd rather be in a good situation. You know, we'd rather be where this relationship is working, or this team is cranking, or I'm coming home and we're really enjoying being together. So most of the time when that shift has been made effectively, my experience is we're going to stick with it because we like it a lot better than being miserable in a relationship.
That is so amazing. And I think all of this information is so important. So I wanted to ask you, where can actually people get copies of your book, Understanding Other People, The Five Secrets to Human Behavior?
The book is everywhere. It's on Amazon, of course, and BN.com, and it's in most regional and national bookstores. If it's not there, you can ask for it. They can order it.
Fantastic. Beverly, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great.
It was absolutely a pleasure. You were great. Thank you.
That's two-time best-selling author, behavior expert, and career coach, Beverly Flaxington. Check out her website, understandingotherpeople.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. No one likes being the bad guy, but there are times when we have to own up to our misdeeds and apologize. Saying sorry when you're in the wrong is a real test of pride and humility. But for relationships to thrive, we have to be willing to admit our mistakes and to ask for forgiveness in order to forge ahead onto better pastures. It's easy to revert to the childish stance of, I'm not saying sorry until you say sorry, or to rely on the old passive-aggressive line, I'm sorry if you think I did something wrong. Drop all of that. If you really want to repair a relationship that's on the rocks, you have to leave your ego at the door and acknowledge your faults. So if you've done and or said something that has hurt your significant other and you sincerely want to apologize, here are a few tips on how to do it effectively. First, assess the situation. How bad is the fallout? Is your partner not talking to you at all? Are they open to communication? You'll need to decide the best way to reach out, whether it's by email, phone, or in person. While it's important to allow some time for both sides to cool off, don't wait too long to give your apology, or you'll be met with a much higher wall of resentment. Since you are the offender, you have to respect your partner's space and the pace they set for the interaction. You can't shove an apology down their ears if they're not ready to hear it yet, but you need to let them know that you'd like to speak to them, in person if possible, so that you can apologize. Saying the word sorry is not difficult. It's the circumstances that surround the reason for the apology that makes it challenging. Not only is it a potentially embarrassing exercise, but it can be painful as well, because apologizing requires both of you to relive the ugly incident that took place. That's why so many run from making apologies, or at best do half-hearted make-up favors that don't directly address what happened, but an apology is implied. So it's flowers, gifts, or just being extra nice and carrying on as if nothing happened, hoping your partner will take the hint and drop the issue. Now, gifts and niceties are, well, nice, but be careful not to have those serve as a substitute for saying sorry. Buying one's way out of an apology sets up an unhealthy pattern in a relationship and does nothing to solve the issue. If you want to get your partner a gift, or do something romantic for them as a way to make up, Save that for after the apology. So let's get to the bare bones of it. How do you give a good apology? Well, there's some main points you need to hit. First, be specific. Break down exactly what you did wrong, what you said, what you did, and then acknowledge the fact that it hurt your partner. Without offering any excuses, take ownership of your actions and claim responsibility for the role you played in the incident. Right away, you'd have accomplished about 80% of the challenge. Accepting responsibility is major, and your partner will appreciate that. You could almost end there, but we won't. There are a couple finishing touches that will put the issue to rest and your relationship back on track. After your detailed apology, include what I like to call a forward statement. Basically, state your intentions going forward from this point. Make a promise to not repeat the offense. And since you already listed every painful point, you both know exactly what it is. You can also ask for your partner's patience towards this end, as it may take you a few tries to correct your behavior. And finally, ask for forgiveness. You've laid it all on the line and put the power back in their hands. Again, this will test your pride, but if you love this person, it's worth it. Now, if your partner decides they are unable to forgive you, you have to accept that. An apology doesn't guarantee forgiveness. Sometimes the damage we've done is irreversible. The best you can do at that point is to forgive yourself, be at peace with the situation, and be proud of yourself for at least being brave enough to say, "I'm sorry."
Going up to my guests this week, Poor Young Things, Beverly Flaxington, and Gina Lee. Here's your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Lou Holtz. Your talent determines what you can do. Your motivation determines how much you are willing to do. Your attitude determines how well you do it. Thank you so much for hanging out. Don't forget to check us out on social media, on Twitter, at @KAlexanderShow, on YouTube, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow, also on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and as always, on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. If you have any comments or questions, Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.